It's Monday, November 9th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Coming up, voters in Myanmar cast ballots in an historic national election.
I think it was a lot of symbolism. I think both presidents were interested in their legacy.
An historic meeting is held between the leaders of Taiwan and China. Also ahead, security concerns deepen in the wake of the Russian passenger jet crash. Puff Daddy has something new for you to hear. And best of all, it's free. It's all coming up on today's International Edition. Vote counting is underway in Myanmar following the nation's first free election in a quarter of a century. Jubilant voters were seen walking out of local stations with their small fingers dipped in black ink, indicating that they had cast their ballot, many for the first time in their lives. Some 32 million people were registered to vote to select for more than 6,000 candidates for both houses of the national parliament and regional assemblies. Election officials say the turnout was quite high, about 80%. Joining us is David Steinberg. He's professor emeritus of Asian studies at Georgetown University. Professor Steinberg, how is the election different from 25 years ago when the military intervened?
The military intervened then because they had said they were going to have a multi-party election. The question was election for what? The opposition and the U.S. and others said it's for a new government. And the military basically said no, it's for a constitutional convention to form a new constitution, after which you'd get elections for a new government. They ignored that. In any case, they were shocked by the fact that the NLD won 80% of the seats and 57% of the vote. In this particular case, they know very clearly that their international legitimacy, and indeed a lot of their internal legitimacy, depends on having this election go reasonably well. They have not the capacity nationally everywhere to run a good election. But the question is, will this be seen as reasonable? Ben Rhodes said something very smart the other day at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, where he gave a talk. He said there's a difference between basically government intent and government capacity. We understand the government doesn't have the capacity to do everything. But if their intent is to limit the elections, that is really serious. That's a distinction that I think we have to keep in mind.
Aung San Suu Kyi, of course, is not able to be president because of laws passed. However, she has indicated that if her party wins, she could be essentially above the presidency.
That is a very dangerous statement. First of all, we have to understand she could not be vice president either. It's not just president. And there was a case in July 2011 where the military nominated a person for vice president but had to withdraw the nomination because he had a child who was married to a foreigner. While the provision of the Constitution may have been directed towards Aung San Suu Kyi, it has had other implications. But her statement that she is above the president or could be above the president is, I think, very much of concern. She has talked all during her campaigns and every time that she's been talking about the rule of law. But the highest law of any country is the Constitution, whether we like it or not, whether we agree with all the provisions or not. And yet she says, I am essentially going to be above the Constitution. That, I think, is dangerous for a number of points of view, because her role and the role of evolving democratic government depends upon the trust of the military. And I think that she has diminished the trust in the military in her by that kind of statement.
It will be several days before we know the results of the elections. Does this create a problem?
No, I don't think so, because it's very difficult to get all these votes counting in at one particular time because a lot of the areas are really quite remote. But at the same time, there is obviously possibility of fraud. But I think that if there were to be fraud, it would not be at a level to really affect the total results. I think the NLD will do very well. I don't know whether they will get a majority or not. I think the minorities will do very well. Minorities will be looking to both the NLD and the government party and the military to see with whom can we ally to get the most for the future.
David Steinberg is Professor Emeritus of Asian Studies at Georgetown University. Professor, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And, of course, when available, Myanmar election results will be available right here on International Edition, as well as our website, voanews.com. You know, it's not even Thanksgiving yet. But as soon as people started putting away their Halloween decorations, well, you know what happened. Many stores started rolling out their Christmas products. One store, though, is facing some criticism online for how its product is being portraying the winter holiday. And for that, on our social media segment, G. Abby Lee is here in Studio 22 with details. Hi, G.
Hi, Jim. So it all started with one man's rant against the coffee house chain Starbucks. An Arizona man named Joshua Feuerstein posted a video on Facebook that received more than 1 million views. He argued in the clip that Starbucks removed Christmas from their cups because they hate Jesus.
Whoa.
Let me backtrack and explain for our international listeners. So every winter, Starbucks offers special holiday cups. One year it had snowmen on it, another year it had Christmas trees on it, so the design really varies. But this year the company went for just varying shades of red without any graphics.
And that's what this man's unhappy about?
Very unhappy. So his solution was to ask people to give their name as Merry Christmas when they order their cup of Java, so the employees are forced to say that phrase and write it on the paper cup. He also urged people to take a selfie with a cup and post it on social media with hashtag Merry Christmas Starbucks.
So how's that taking off?
Not too shabbily. It's one of the top 10 trending hashtags on Facebook right now. And let me give you an example. A woman in her 30s posted a selfie on Facebook like Feuerstein suggested and wrote, among other things, this. It seems that political correctness, more often than not, comes at the expense of God-fearing men and women. I love Jesus, I celebrate his birth, and I have the right to acknowledge it without persecution or the fear of offending. But of course, not all Christians are on board with this trend. Benjamin L. Corey, who is a well-known progressive Christian blogger and author, tweeted this. Keeping Christ in Christmas is completely different than keeping Christ on a cup. Hashtag Merry Christmas Starbucks. Corey is on Twitter at Benjamin Corey, and he's a prominent figure in what's called the emerging church movement.
Gee, how is Starbucks reacting to this movement?
Well, it hasn't mentioned this at all either on Facebook or Twitter, but you know what they say. No publicity is bad publicity. And I bet the company's CEO, who is not a Christian, by the way, is not complaining about people mentioning the company's name over and over again. Back to you.
Interesting story. Well, thank you, G, for that perspective. G. Abby Lee tweets on our VOA International Edition Twitter account. That would be at VOA underscore IE. And you can also follow her on her own account at G. Abby Lee. This is VOA.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
News is mobile, and so are you. Get VOA on the go. Get VOA on Google Currents. Get VOA News specifically made for your tablet and smartphone. Clean, simple, fast. Now available for Android or Apple phones or tablets. Download the Google Currents app for free today. Get VOA on Google Currents at voanews.com/currents.
This is VOA's International Edition. Taiwan President Ma Ying-jeou says the importance of security and dignity to the Taiwanese people was one of the key messages that he shared with China's President Xi Jinping on Saturday when the leaders of the two sides met for the first time in more than six decades. During that hour-long meeting, President Ma told reporters he raised concerns about China's deployment of missiles across the Taiwan Strait. Ma said President Xi said the missiles are not aimed at Taiwan. Well, we turn to Bill Sharp, who's host of Asia in Review, based in Hawaii, to find out more about this meeting. Bill, were there any big surprises here?
I don't think there's anything, at least immediately substantive, that came out of it. There weren't any agreements signed. You know, a joint statement wasn't made. Xi Jinping did suggest that Taiwan would be welcome to participate in what the Chinese call the Yi Lu Yi Dai, or the One Belt, One Road, which is a huge developmental program designed to link Asia with Europe. He also said that Taiwan would be welcome into the Asian Investment and Infrastructure Bank. And he also suggested, and I think maybe this would be really interesting to people in Taiwan, that he could agree to more international space for Taiwan if it didn't somehow lead to statehood.
It was the first such meeting between leaders from the mainland and Taiwan in 66 years. Why now?
A lot of suggestion has been given to both of these gentlemen wanted to have this meeting to enhance the prospects for the KMT, the Nationalist Party, Maoist Party, in the upcoming January 2016 presidential and legislative elections. I think that this was probably more of a goal for Xi than it was for Ma. Xi is definitely worried that Tsai Ing-wen will come to power, the DPP will come to power, the Democratic Progressive Party, her party, and promote independence. I personally don't think that's going to happen. I think she's pragmatic. I think that her goal is going to be to rebuild Taiwan's domestic economy, because that's where people, the greatest number of people in Taiwan, are worried about, the hollowing out of Taiwan's economy. I think it was a lot of symbolism. I think both presidents were interested in their legacy. President Ma is getting near the end of his term, and as leaders in, it seems every country do, when they get near the end of the term, they're worried about how history is going to look back on them. And President Xi, well, he's not near the end of his term. He certainly wants to be recognized as a leader. I mean, he's had some pretty high-profile visits around the world lately, to Washington, to the UK, and now to Singapore. And I think this is all to build up his image as the person to deal with in China.
Usually, after a meeting between two presidents, there is a rather anticlimactic press conference. In this case, there were two press conferences. President Ma addressed the media and answered a few questions, and his comments were carried live within Taiwan.
Right.
President Xi did not attend his press conference, but instead an aide read a statement. From what I understand, CCTV did not present this live, but rather presented edited segments from these press conferences. This kind of says a lot about the situation between the two.
Yeah, this is very typical mainland style. They're very selective in what they broadcast in on sensitive political issues in China. Yeah, a lot of it is highly edited. Taiwan media is very aggressive, and Taiwan has freedom of the press, so there's going to be all kinds of coverage in Taiwan.
Does this open the door for future direct meetings between the two leaders?
Well, that's a question that remains to be seen. I think there's another aspect here. The meeting was arranged somewhat in the black box, as they call it, without much transparency and sort of at the last minute. Taiwan right now is sort of at a point where it's very concerned about its over-reliance on China. It's worried about growing Chinese influence in Taiwan. And to see President Ma go to meet President Xi, this could have a negative consequence back in Taiwan, especially if it's seen as meddling in the Taiwan elections.
Bill Sharp is host of Asia in Review. That's based in Honolulu, Hawaii. Bill, thank you so much for joining us today.
You're quite welcome. Have a good day.
Washington is renewing its focus on international aviation security as evidence increasingly points to the possibility a bomb destroyed a Russian passenger airliner over Egypt's Sinai Peninsula, killing all 224 people aboard the jet. A social media communication purportedly from Islamic State once again claimed responsibility for the disaster. VOA Senate correspondent Michael Bowman joins me in the studio. Understandably, U.S. lawmakers are concerned about the implications.
Lawmakers are concerned. There are a number of them that are already saying that they are operating under the assumption that it was a bomb and that Islamic State was responsible, and that the United States needs to act as though that is the case and needs to put plans in place and take actions on the assumption that that will be proved once there is some definitive report coming from the Egyptians and the Russians. What does this mean? According to Peter King and Adam Schiff, a top Republican and a top Democrat in the House of Representatives, what they see is the possibility of terrorists being in cahoots, possibly with ground personnel, at some of these more regional airports. Remember that the Russian jetliner didn't take off from Cairo. It took off from an Egyptian resort town. And that at some of these airports where perhaps security isn't quite as beefed up as it might be in a major capital, what you have is the possibility of a group like Islamic State to bribe or somehow infiltrate the ground crew, get something on board, and the plane takes off and it explodes in midair.
Was the talk aimed primarily at international flights?
I think right now the greater concern is in a place like Egypt. Any place where there might be some adherent of Islamic State, the fear is that this has exposed a real weakness in international aviation, and that this could be exploited just as it was in Egypt, that it could be exploited in any number of different places.
Mm-hmm. We are always happy to have you and your insights with us.
Thank you, Jim.
And you're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. That's Encounter every Saturday and Sunday on VOA.
Hashtag VOA. It's a weekly show, Tuesdays at 1730 UTC, where we bring you the top topics of the week. But the show lives on social media every day with your daily video shorts, What's Trending Wednesday, and the Friday Fast Five. Subscribe to the show at YouTube. You can find us at hashtag VOA. You can reach me at Twitter, at Perry Cal, or talk to the show anytime. Please don't forget to like us on Facebook. We like to be liked. We love to be seen. And you can reach us anytime.
Hip-hop entertainer and entrepreneur Puff Daddy has released a new mixtape, and he's offering it free of charge. International Edition's David Byrd spoke with VOA Soul Lounge host Shauna Renee about money-making Mitch and what's next for the 46-year-old music mogul.
A mixtape usually means you're going to get the artist plus a lot of cameos, guest appearances. It also implies that much of what you're hearing is probably freestyle, was created on the spot, not really thought out, didn't really go through the entire process that one goes through when creating an album. He has another album that will be dropping, No Way Out 2, which he says will be his final album. But Money Making Mitch, this is the mixtape to kind of wet our palates, if you will. And he's asked Lil' Kim and Wiz Khalifa, who is huge now, French Montana, Jadakiss, Future, who is very big, and Pharrell offered up their services as producers. So in listening to this, it sounds very updated, very contemporary, which says a lot for a man who has been in the game now for 20 plus years.
Money Making Mitch is this fairy tale, you know, about this fly from Harlem that came up and he did his thing, man. He was shining on him, styling on him, showing how to do it, showing him how to get it. Maybe he was getting it the wrong way, but you know, the fairy tale of it is most brothers and sisters end up dead or in jail.
Now, this character, or this money-making Mitch character, is actually based on Mekhi Phifer's character from a movie, right?
From the movie Paid in Full. And so he essentially takes the character and kind of flushes him out. And sort of like Puffy, he talks about, in this mixtape, growing up in Harlem, being a hustler, then becoming an entrepreneur, making it against all odds. So it's based on that character, but it is also based on his own experience.
Some of the tracks, it's interesting. I listened to a few of the tracks because it's streaming.
Mm-hmm.
And some of them are really, really nice. Some of them, you know, very, very smooth. And some of them are a little bit more in your face.
Yeah, that's the mixtape. That's what the mixtape will give you, a mixture of all kinds of different things. And, you know, again, Puffy has always said, he contends always that he's an entertainer. And so he's never been afraid to talk about the fact that he works with ghostwriters. He's never been afraid to admit that he works in a very collaborative way with producers and other artists. So he is there purely to entertain you. And so whatever he's feeling at the moment or whatever he thinks the times call for, that's what he's giving you, which is slightly different maybe from other artists.
And it always helps when you can call Pharrell on the phone and say, can you come help me produce this thing?
Exactly.
Well, if you have any questions or comments about Money Making Mitch or about Puff Daddy, you can send a tweet to Shauna. She's at VOA Lady DJ. You can also send one to us. We are at VOA underscore IE. And you can log on to our website. That's voanews.com.
For some time now, and I don't know what it is, but girl, girl, you got me, yeah.
Hey, I'm still a little old school in this digital age. It's always fun to hear the term mixtape. You've been listening to International Edition. You can find us at voanews.com. And you can also find us on Twitter. Follow us at VOA underscore IE. Our director is Tracy Carter, our engineer Cornelius Tenner, and I'm Jim Stevenson. We're all in Washington. We thank you for joining us. Come back again and see us. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The U.S. Navy recently concluded a two-week training session in Trincomalee to equip and support Sri Lanka's underwater demining efforts. Working with side-scan sonars and robots donated by the U.S. Navy, the Sri Lankan Navy enhanced its ability to search, locate, and provide information on any unknown items underwater, including unexploded ordnance from the conflict in Trincomalee Harbor. The United States is committed to aiding demining efforts across Sri Lanka, whether on land or at sea, said U.S. Ambassador Atul Kisep. By removing these remnants of war, we are helping ensure Sri Lankans can live and work more safely. This effort also increases the ability for the port of Trincomalee to expand its commercial operations. This recent exercise is part of continuing U.S. assistance for demining efforts across the country. From 1995 to 2014, the U.S. has invested more than $46 million to fund mine clearance, survey projects, mine risk education, and national capacity building. In his October 8th meeting with the Honorable D.M. Swaminathan, Minister of Rehabilitation, Resettlement, and Hindu Religious Affairs, Ambassador Kisep announced an additional $1,745,000 in support of demining activities in Sri Lanka. U.S. assistance to Sri Lanka's demining efforts have also included the transfer of safety and field equipment, surveys on mine contamination for detection and land release, and mine clearing operations. The United States is also leading efforts to boost Sri Lanka's own demining capacity through training for mine disposal units in the Sri Lankan military, including the mine detection dog and underwater demining programs. Sri Lanka's northern Puttikuttarupu district was one of the worst hit areas during Sri Lanka's decades-long civil war. When the U.S. State Department helped the Mines Advisory Group, or MAG, a non-governmental demining assistance organization, become the first humanitarian demining organization to operate in the area in 2010, they encountered destroyed buildings and abandoned military camps littered with minefields and unexploded ordnance. After 4 years of work, more than 9,000 families were able to return home. The United States is proud to work with Sri Lanka and its non-governmental partners to free the people of Sri Lanka from the deadly threat of landmines.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.